like it's on. Yeah, the emphasis will be on inflation, its relation to gravity waves, and the prospects for us actually being able to detect the influence of gravity waves on the cosmic microwave background, which is an extremely exciting thing. I won't go through the details of this aspect. We'll be going through this in the talk. My focus will be on the dynamical and resolution trajectories or histories for inflation then, that is to say, the early moments of the universe, as opposed to an equivalent problem, which is inflation now, associated with the nature of the dark energy. So, in leading into this, I'm going to give you an update of all of the exciting action that has occurred in the cosmic microwave background over the past year from an observational point of view and what the implications have been. For some reason, there it is. Okay, so inflationary history. So, as you probably are all aware of, this is the cosmic microwave background as seen by WMAP, where there's actually been some attempts to take out the galaxy, which would be this bound. Up here is the North Galactic Pole, the South Galactic Pole. So I think everybody's probably familiar with this. So there are many possible topics that I could go into of direct relevance for theory in Canada and elsewhere. But I'm going to be focusing on the inflation histories, but putting this into context. In a sense, this is what one might call a subdominant phenomena, because why is this interesting? It's interesting to the extent that the results from inflation may not be a very simple spectrum reflected by a simple power law approximation, which has really been the dominant thing in terms of parameter analysis of the cosmic microwave background. There are other examples of subdominant phenomena. For example, there could be an isocurvature component as well as the curvature component to the fluctuations in the microwave background that we believe and think that the microwave background has provided strong evidence for that the universe grew out of curvature fluctuations. And the smoking gun is certainly that it generated an inflationary effect. Another aspect of this, which I won't go into at all, are whether or not there are non-Gaussian signatures arising from the primordial epoch that you would find in the cosmic microwave background. The thing about the cosmic microwave background is that it's full of non-Gaussian signals. They're called foregrounds, galactic, for example, or sources from extragalactic sources. So to actually try and address the issue of, is there primordial non-Gaussianity arising from an inflationary epoch or something else, possibly at the end, possibly associated with cosmic strings or something similar, you have to first of all deal with the fact that the dominant non-Gaussian signals are foregrounds and have to take that fully into account. We won't be talking about that today. Intimately related to the inflationary histories and our ability to determine aspects of this is the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. In particular, that's where the smoking gun of the impact of gravity waves is, as I'll be explaining as the talk goes along. There is a whole other area that we call secondary anisotropies, which are imprinted upon the cosmic microwave background once matter has begun to evolve to nonlinearity. You'll get an indication of this. This is another one of the major frontiers of research in the cosmic microwave background, something that we're very much engaged in at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics, but it is not going to be something that I'll be talking very much about here. I'll just mention at one point. Another extremely interesting subject, and I see people in the audience who are very much into this, associated with us, is Yiki. Dark energy histories as opposed to inflationary histories. The cosmic microwave background is fundamental to any forward movement in terms of determining what the nature of the dark energy is in the universe. But it isn't because it's going to be able by itself to give us that much information. It's because it's going to determine and is determining the other cosmological parameters with such high precision. And that's essential for any of the techniques that are being proposed to deal with dark energy. So for example, methods using weak lensing, using supernova, and Ray Carlberg will be talking about this later. If you don't have the evidence from the microwave background, you don't get that far in terms of by themselves determining the nature of the dark energy. Galactic foregrounds, in a sense, these are secondary anisotropies, but they are what many would refer to as a nuisance from the point of view of the pristine aspect of the cosmic microwave background as a way of probing ultra-early universe issues. But on the other hand, if your interests are the interstellar medium, this is what is most important about the data that we have now and the data that's emerging from the cosmic microwave background. So just to put things into context, and I won't spend much time on this because more or less by now, everybody who's a working theoretical physicist probably is pretty much aware of the grand story of the cosmic microwave background. But let's just put into context so that the major aspect of the fluctuations arise from when the universe is, the redshift or the compression factor of the universe is about 1100, when the universe went from tightly coupled in the photons to the baryons to transparent, propagating to us through all of the ripples along the way, which also breeds fluctuations. But the primary aspect of fluctuations are essentially direct maps of what's occurring at redshift around 1100. So there are a lot of neat little pieces of information here, which I won't be talking about, but I will talk about, I mentioned secondary anisotropies, which is what happens later as the photons propagate through an emerging cosmic web of structure, which is dominated by first galaxies and filaments connecting the galaxies, then clusters of galaxies with filaments connecting the clusters of galaxies. So these have major influences. In particular, there's something called the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect, which happens when the photons pass through hot gas and they get upscattered through Thompson scattering. Actually, Compton scattering. Anyway, this builds anisotropies, and there are anisotropies of various sorts. And large-scale structure will loom to be important in some of the parameter analyses we'll be talking about. Okay, so in order to take the inflationary story one step further, let me just try and remind you of the basic set of parameters that people have been dealing with for quite a while in the inflationary realm, and then we will start to build upon that to discuss more complex inflationary histories. So one issue is what is the background curvature of the universe? This parameter is one that from the great results of the boomerang experiment and then followed on by the first year of WMAP-1 and other experiments, we learn that the universe is very nearly flat. From the microwave background itself, we can't tell that it's exactly flat because it turns out that there's an important degeneracy of parameters that it could, in fact, be closed. But with fairly minor extra assumptions, the Hubble parameter somewhere between 100, this already does enough of a restriction to really focus you on the flat option. So that is the most likely outcome of inflationary models. It isn't necessary, but it's the most likely outcome. And so flatness is something that for the remainder of the talk, I will be making the assumption is correct. Then there is the baryon density, the dark matter density, the cosmological constant, that is to say the measure of the vacuum energy. This is the thing that could be more complex associated with the dark energy history, so it could be, in fact, time-dependent. Then there is the optical depth to last scattering. When did the stars reionize? One of the results that has been quite major in terms of the three-year release of WMAP data compared to the first-year release is that there has been a relatively significant downward movement of the value of the optical depth to last scattering, and that's extremely important because it makes it even it was a little bit awkward for those people that were dealing with the formation of first stars to have formed them early enough in order to make the optical depth that came from the first year of WMAP data. Okay, then there are a number of parameters that are characterizing the initial conditions that grow as the universe occurs and that we can get a handle on from the microwave background. There's the spectral index of primordial scalar or compressional perturbations. These are the things that, these are the curvature perturbations, and this is describing the structural aspect of the power spectrum of the scalar perturbations that grow to describe the evolution of the density perturbations of matter as we observe them now. But then there's also the possibility of tensor perturbations, gravity wave perturbations, and that has its own spectral index, its own structural aspect. Then there is an overall amplitude for the scalar fluctuations. This is intimately related to something that's more important for structure formation at late times that in the game we affectionately call sigma 8. It's a measure of the power on the scales associated with clusters of galaxies, and of course, clusters of galaxies are the characteristic nonlinear objects in the present universe, galaxies being the nonlinear objects of an earlier time. In any case, that's going to loom a bit as the talk proceeds. But there's a scalar amplitude and a tensor amplitude. That is to say, four parameters that seem to be fundamental for us to try and, at a minimum level, explain the basic parameterization of inflation. Okay, so let's count the number of parameters. We're going to get rid of this one. One, two, three, four, and then four more. But the four more are very rarely added in terms of analyses. The issue is the data ready for this? And the answer is yes, it's becoming ready for it. But usually a relationship is made between the tensor amplitude and the tensor tilt, and sometimes even this is taken to be zero, so that often it would be three parameters when you include tensors. Now, often, and the minimal aspect and much of the press about the microwave background, you actually try and set this one equal to zero and then just deal with a minimal six-parameter set. And so we will be describing how one goes beyond that with the microwave background. Okay, so the analysis of the microwave background, usually what we're doing is compressing information on large-scale maps like this, which is the three-year WMAP map of fluctuations in the microwave background after you've taken away the dipole, which is the largest component of all, but it's very broad on this scale, and it's just due to our motion. The compression is an analysis, assuming that the data, the primordial aspect of the data in any case, is represented by an isotropic power spectrum describing the fluctuations as a function of scale. And this is affectionately called CL, and it has the familiar ups and downs which are associated with the acoustic oscillations associated with the oscillations in the baryon photon fluid at redshift around 11,000. And then there's a characteristic damping. Okay, I think this is pretty familiar to people. So now let's go to a little bit of the excitement over the data release this year from WMAP 3. So this is the year one data, the year three data, and the difference between the year three and the year one data. There is almost no difference. This is what we, in effect, expected, because we didn't expect that if WMAP did its job right in its first year, that most of the The results are, in fact, what we call cosmic variance limited. That is to say, the noise in the observations isn't that important. It turns out, of course, to be important on the smallest angular scales, and that is significant. Okay, so what is the difference between the 3-year WMAP release and the 1-year WMAP release? There are two sets of error bars here, and you can see that the error bars are essentially the same. They're slightly different at the higher L's, and that's because with more data, you could beat down the noise. The 3-year data has, therefore, a smaller error bar here. There's another rather important little bit that's occurred around the first peak of the microwave background, but that actually is not because of the improvement of the data. It is actually because the analysis has changed in terms of how they've weighted points. Okay, so I won't get into that here, except that you might expect that many theorists have been pretty excited about all of the anomalies relative to this basic inflationary curve, things that are slightly low or high relative to the curve. And of course, there's been a lot of intensity in very many papers about this. None of that has changed, except for the issue of how things are weighted. So all of the issues that you've heard about in terms of large-scale structure in the microwave background that might be indicative of fundamental new physics are still there. Nothing's really changed. When you add all of the microwave background together, so one of the things that we've been very, I might say that two of the key players in WMAP 3-year release are actually at CETA, just down the road, Mike Nolte and Olivier Doré. Here is a smaller map of the universe from Boomerang. This we released. Again, it's very much there's a lot of activity at CETA on this. This is a little map of the universe associated with the Boomerang balloon experiment, which was mostly targeting polarization, but did actually an exquisite job on this microwave background power spectrum. And then there is another one that we've been very much engaged in at CETA, which is the cosmic background imager data, also associated with ACBAR. And so the basic bottom line is the little red things are the WMAP data and the other thing, other bits of data on it, and they all agree with this power spectrum, which is essentially a best fit to the WMAP data. Okay. There has been another important thing that has occurred in the last year, and that involves the detection of polarization. Polarization comes in two modes. I really don't have much time to describe what these are in detail, except that one of them is predicted to be associated with scalar perturbations, and the other is primarily associated with gravity wave-induced consequences for the microwave background called the BB mode. We aren't nearly there for the detection of this mode yet, but we have got detections. So these are the detections in red of the WMAP 3-year release. They couldn't do this with the 1-year data. And then there is an important development here for Boomerang 03. It's not in the best possible color here, but that was a significant detection. And probably the best detection to date has been the cosmic background imager, which is here. Why is this important? Well, first of all, it's important because it's related to these things anyway. I will continue to go on. WMAP 3 has seen then in the data the third peak. It only had gotten out to here with the first year data, and now actually starts to map out the third year data. In fact, the fact that this is a little low here has been an extremely important point, believe it or not, in terms of the impact on the total matter content of the universe. Incredible that the data is supposedly in that precision that it's caused a big advance. The Boomerang, this is contrasted with the Boomerang data, which goes a lot further and actually does somewhat better at trying to get that third peak and into the fourth peak. This is the detection of Boomerang contrasted with WMAP for the various polarization modes. But the cosmic background imager has data which goes out better and actually is starting to map out even the fifth peak. So things are pretty impressive. So now let's take a deep breath and look what the future is going to bring as well as the past. We've talked about the cosmic background imager. There is a new cosmic background imager here. One of the big things that Canada has an involvement in, but it's primarily European, is a next generation satellite called Planck, which instead of using the passively cooled HIMPS that are on WMAP, is primarily a bolometer experiment. That means that it's cooled to ultra low temperatures and will be observing for a long time and get high, very high precision data all sky. But also, we have hopes that a spider balloon experiment that will be explicitly targeting the B mode of polarization on low scales will be going. And there's also ACT that we also have some involvement in that is going to be targeting the high L or high resolution region, but on smaller scales. Okay, so this is just giving you the indication that there's a lot of activity. And actually, what I should say is that there is a huge increase in number of detectors that will be going on this next generation. And that will be extremely important in terms of trying to get to the precision needed to see the gravity wave things. Well, in order to do this, there has to be a lot of people who will be engaged in this type of thing. And I will point here to various people at CETA, but in particular, Pascal Vaudrevange, who's in the audience there, working with me and with that great data analyzer, Lev Kaufman, our chair, and also Carlo Cantaldi, who was at CETA and has now moved. So that's going to be the primary set of people I want to talk about the work of here. Okay, so I've already talked about the basic parameters that we're dealing with. The list would be much greater if you take into account that things like the indices, the spectral indices, could be in functions of the three-dimensional wave number. And that's really the complexity that we are keen about introducing and talking about here and what the limits of that are. I won't go into the other parameters. And so here is a current snapshot of the parameters. And I think I am going to essentially jump over this, but just to tell you that everything is very concordant, that is to say in agreement with the basic model involving six parameters without the necessity for gravity waves, and that the various experiments are all in substantive agreement with what are, in effect, the final results, which are these green lines for the various parameters. You know, things like H-naught of some interest, age, when the universe reionized, that's the thing that changed a bit with the current WMAP data. The optical depth, which is extremely important, had a slight change. And from our point of view, this quantity, which is like a measure of the scalar amplitude, but slightly different, sigma 8, has evolved. And that actually gives us a lot of tension. OK, so in that particular compilation, we had not included something which is rather dramatic, which is the combination of all of the cosmic background imager data. We haven't published this yet, but it's sort of hot new results. These are the old results on the various figures. And these are the new results. And so you can see that there's been a tremendous improvement just by bringing two large aspects of the data sets together, which is non-trivial in terms of analysis. So that's pretty exciting. So one of the things that emerges from WMAP is increased tension in something that is extremely significant from the point of view of people in our subject. It's called sigma 8. This is sigma 8 against the spectral index NS. You see that the spectral index is nearly unity, but seems to be, you know, below it. And with error bars that at the two sigma level seem to be away from unity. And that is one of the things that the WMAP release pointed to. But this is the basic six parameter set. One has to be a little careful. Anyway, there is a difference between what seems to be the case with some of the CBI excess at high Ls, and what you would get just from the straight analysis of the data due to primary oscillations. There is also a tension with weak lensing. This is an ongoing story. It's extremely exciting, but it is not really what I want to spend time on, so I'll skip over it and go to the issues of polarization. In particular, a polarization pattern in terms that looks something like this as opposed to this. This is the thing that comes from the scalar perturbations. It also comes from tensor perturbations, but this does not come from scalar perturbations except through lensing. It comes from gravity waves. Okay, so polarization, here is the great result from the WMAP team that's taught us a lot about polarization foregrounds. Then there is some CBI detections of polarization. And what I can say is that the polarization results are quite consistent with the predictions you get from the TT, and that's what this moving figure is supposed to show, that as you change, for example, the value of the curvature of the universe, when you lock in to these sets of peaks here, which is near the curvature being zero, you also lock into the ups and downs of the polarization spectrum. That's a pretty remarkable result. It does indicate that there aren't other sources. Okay, but now I want to turn in my remaining half hour to the inflation trajectories, and I'm sorry that this is that the intro, which was long-winded, has taken so long, but you know, it's been a pretty exciting year. So let's go back to a different a set of two of the parameters. One is the parameter which is describing the ratio of the amplitude of tensor to scalar perturbations, that's here, and the spectral index for scalar perturbations. So this is what happens if you just include WMAP. This is a 2 sigma thing, and around here is 1 sigma. This is in brown when you add all of the microwave background together, and this is when you add large-scale structured data together with it. And so you can see that as you add more data, and this is quite similar to the result we had before WMAP3, but as you add more data, you get less and less engagement with the spectral index of unity, and you tend to get a value which is below. Okay, that's pretty exciting, because that means that it isn't a scale invariant spectrum, it's a nearly scale invariant spectrum, and that's actually something that's required from inflation. But that's a very simple two-parameter determination. I talked a little bit about the balloon experiment that we're quite excited about, SPIDER, that would fly in 2009. And I also talked about the satellite Planck. Both of them have a good shot at the detection of the gravity waves. It's non-trivial because this is the scalar signal, and this is adding the tensor. So I'm going to go back and forth. You see that there's a slight difference, but it's very small. So the precision that's required in order to go after this is enormous. Okay, this is adding a forecast for 2.5 years of Planck data out at the second Lagrangian point, and 100 or 10, just 10 days of SPIDER data, which we think we can do better than. And this is the famous B mode. The thing that with the ups and downs that we've been observing, this is a focus on the low Ls, that is values of order 1,000 in microkelvin squared. Here we're trying to detect signals which are 0.01, 0.02 microkelvin squared, so they're really tiny, and yet you can see that if we can control the foregrounds, which we think we should be able to do, you can get detections at this level. So that's extremely exciting, because that would be the smoking gun of inflation. However, this is within the context of that overall simple parameterization in terms of, this is what you would get to determine the power spectrum. Now, it turns out that the nature of the gravity waves is that it would provide a direct measure of the acceleration parameter of the universe. Q is called the deceleration parameter. Epsilon, which is 1 plus this deceleration parameter, is often called the slow roll parameter. But in fact, as a parameter, it doesn't have anything to do with slow roll and inflation. Okay, so now I want to go a little bit into the background of inflation and the concept of the trajectories. So often, inflation in this day and age is a little more complex than the simple potentials that you're probably used to. This is one that was very popular, at least a couple of years ago, called the KKLMMT class of potentials that actually were protected and were realizable. And the idea is that the inflaton flows around here and then flows down to there effectively, and associated with movements in this direction are the curvature fluctuations. Transverse movements, which actually damp down, are called isocurvature fluctuations. Okay, everything got highly enriched within the context of the landscape, and there are many aspects to this, which I don't have any time to go into, except that if one is really opening up the space, there are at least 14 standard inflation parameters as opposed to the 3 or 4 that I talked about. And if you are considering that the that you don't have really simple limitations on inflation, there are many more parameters. And so the question is, will any acceleration trajectory do? And that is what we have been probing a lot at CETA with Pascal and with Lev and with Carlo Cantaldi. And so the issues are, and the things that are of interest for us, is an attempt to try and reconstruct the acceleration history of the universe from the observations, or equivalently the Hubble parameter of the universe, how it's evolving, which in fact is intimately related to the potentials. Okay, now what we showed, what I showed you was this sort of classic kind of potential called the hybrid inflation potential with deep troughs with propagation. Now there are other kinds of potential which are possible, and this has got us reasonably excited at CETA, Pascal, and has been heavily involved in this, Lev, but I want to mention in particular Sergei Prokushkin, whose code is associated with this. And so you can see that actually in fairly simple models, you can get complex potential surfaces with different possible trajectories. And this is a 2D contour showing different kinds of trajectories. What is the lesson behind this? The lesson is that what is evolving is that inflation is quite maybe quite complex, and many possibilities arise, and that's the context in which we have been trying to do our work in terms of the various possible trajectories. So now, unfortunately, because of time, I'm going to have to take you through some figures fairly quickly, but this is adding complexity to the inflationary story, and I want to show you what happens when you do that associated with allowing any inflationary spectrum. So I won't describe in detail how we do this, but there has been a technique that's been used in inflation called RG flow, or supposedly renormalization group, it's got nothing to do with it, that was used in this space of R against NS. Recall that we looked at those contours before. These are those contours. And these are supposedly models coming from the RG flow. And what we didn't like about this is that it seemed to indicate that there was a lot, most of the models were in direct avoidance of the region that was observed. But once you open up that space, and there are various ways of doing this, which is what we've explored, you end up completely covering this RNS thing with allowed models. Okay, so that was one point. Now, but the major point, though, is that if you allow the complexity to open up, you do not have a unique value of the tensor to scalar ratio R or the spectral index NS, but in fact, different models give you trajectories in that space. So it's actually not the correct thing to look at when you're actually trying to analyze the microwave background, unless you have some reason to suppose that R is fixed and NS is fixed, which you don't. Okay, so that's not the good thing to do. So we've expanded in Chebyshev components. So now I'm afraid I'm going to take a quick couple of minutes here, or a minute or two, to actually show you what happens as you add complexity. So here is the power spectrum and the 1 sigma band about it, the power spectrum in the simplest inflationary model that's reconstructed from all of the data, including the large-scale structure data, as well as all of the current microwave background data, including the 3-year WMAP data. So this is sort of the observable range. It actually extends somewhat further. This is three-dimensional wave number, and this is the power spectrum. This is starting with the assumption that there are no gravity waves at all. And so the basic point is that you have not allowed very much structure, but there is a slope which is attempted with the basic 6 parameters because the slope is allowed. That's the extra ingredient as well as overall amplitude in the inflationary story. So that's the scalar spectrum in that simple story. Now we're going to add one more parameter, which is assume that there's a constant tensor component, which changes the value, and there's a 95% confidence limit of less than 0.22 with all of the data. These red things here are the gravity wave spectra that are allowed, and these are the, which is therefore a very large range, and this is the scalar spectrum, which is allowed, which is actually very, very similar to this one, which is not surprising. Okay, so that's going the usual route in terms of adding single parameters. Now let's add one more, which is to allow more complexity in the scalar spectrum. We are going to add just two and one case that I showed you before. I'm going to compare this with adding what is in effect 5 parameters for the scalars and 5 parameters for the tensors. And you can see what the response is there, that actually the spectrum is trying to do a downturn over the observable range. And to respond to this, what it's trying to do is increase the gravity waves. So this is a result that took us really by surprise. This is what all of the data is indicating, that as you add potential complexity to the spectrum, it actually has a desire to turn down the scalars and turn up the gravity waves. Okay, but that isn't really how we want to do business. What we want to do is to build in an inflationary model from the very beginning, and to do that, we make trajectories in this parameter 1 plus the deceleration parameter, that is to say the slow roll parameter epsilon. And so this is what we were looking at before. And this is that same region, but with that as the expansion. So this is a direct relationship between, there is a direct relationship between the amplitude of the, or the spectrum of the gravity waves and the scalar perturbations. And so this is it's sort of on the same scale. And so you see that we have some gravity wave component. So this is about the simplest thing you can do and gives an upper limit to the gravity waves of 0.32. One of the things that you can get from this particular technique, but not from this, is a reconstruction of the Hubble parameter in the early universe, and that would be this. And this one, which you can hardly see, is a reconstruction of what 1 plus the acceleration parameter is, the slow roll parameter epsilon. You'll see this in more detail as we add complexity. The other thing that you can derive from this is the potential of the fluctuations as a function of scalar field phi. And so it's got a fairly large range. This is because you can't determine the amplitude because of degeneracies very well with the microwave background. So this is actually the result that really, in our view, should be used as opposed to the standard ones where you're using R and NS as separate variables disconnected. Okay, so now we're going to add a little more complexity. This is the equivalent of what is, in effect, a running aspect of the acceleration. And so this is the old result, this is the old result we were looking at with the less than 0.32. And this is, actually, I should take this back. This is actually assuming uniform acceleration. I'll skip over that. You can see that in both cases there are interesting gravity waves component. But I'm going to go to a higher order, and then I'm going to go to a higher order, and then I'm going to try and let Lev be less excited. Here we're looking at, again, the order 2 thing that I was using is the fiducial indicator before with the values of the scalars and the gravity waves. And look what happens when you just go to one more order. It wants to downturn, and in response to that, it's wanting to increase the gravity waves. The gravity wave observables are only down here at relatively low k because the gravity waves fall off substantially at high resolution, high L. And so that's where it's got an implication. And what's happening here is that in order to have placed the strong constraints, there was a direct relationship between high k and low k associated with a simple scale, if it was just a power law. And so it meant that you got constraints associated with what was happening with large-scale structure on the lower k scale. And that stops when you add more complexity to the spectrum. So we have Hubble parameter, and we have now growing the 1 plus the acceleration parameter of the universe with the potentials in response. Upper limit has now grown in gravity waves to 0.54. Now we come to the much larger range where we've added 10 parameters in the description of the complexity of the inflationary trajectories. And so it's got the same kind of response, but what it wants to do is to turn down the scalar spectrum again, and to compensate, it wants to build up the gravity wave spectrum. So that's pretty interesting. Is that truth? Well, we have tried to be as agnostic as possible in terms of our assumptions about inflationary trajectories, and that's the result we get. We have a fairly complex 1 plus acceleration parameter, quite different from the uniform one. And this is the Hubble parameter and the derived inflationary potential. Okay, I was going to describe a way in which by enforcing more restrictions on the nature of inflation, namely that this epsilon be monotonic, we end up with an entirely different regime with an entirely different result, which is that we come up with the low energy inflation as opposed to the higher energy inflation associated with these results. So that's extremely interesting, and unfortunately it brings to bear the fundamental issue, which is nobody knows what the correct prior probability is. So our attitude has been, let's just be open about all possible inflationary trajectories. But we are trying to then say, well, what happens if we make this restriction? What happens if we make that restriction? And so that's one of the responses. So this has got a direct impact on observables. So this is the CL spectrum with all of the ups and downs associated with, one of our cases where we have essentially have it open arbitrarily. And what can be done with SPIDER and with Planck is to make measurements which are sort of this scale. So in other words, there would be a really fairly easy, powerful detection from Planck and SPIDER if we do have this relatively large gravity wave component. But even in the case where we have this low energy inflation, which comes from the monotonicity assumption, we still will be able to get good detections in terms of this. That is to say, our view is that we will be able to control the errors, and it is very likely that we should be able, if there is one, we should be able to get the tensor signal, which is induced by primordial gravity waves on the cosmic microwave background, which is surely an exciting thing. Okay, and that I could put into context, but I shall stop with a summary. And so these are the basic points, but I won't go through them in detail. That's just what I talked about. Okay, sorry for being a bit delayed, but